Buenos días a todos. Bienvenidos a esta sesión del simposio. En esta mesa tenemos cinco ponentes, solo que no sé dónde está Martin Burr, pero aquí. Puede venir y sentarse aquí. Gracias. Y van a hablar a nosotros acerca desde el punto de vista de líderes de las comunidades de fe o grupos religiosos, principalmente. Siempre van a poder decir lo que quieran, pero quiero darles a ellos la bienvenida. Y el tiempo, como siempre, es nuestro enemigo.
As always, time is our enemy. Each will have 10 minutes, and the hope is that we'll have a few minutes at the end for questions and answers, but let's see if we are able to do that. And then after this, we will have our luncheon. And so if you would like to stay and ask questions without eating, that's just fine with me, but I'm not sure that would be a good idea. Or you can continue talking during lunch. I'm just going to introduce the names the best that I can. I'm certain that I'm going to slaughter some of the names, and so I apologize in advance. Elias. Okay, Elias, he is the General Secretary and Regional Director of Religions for Peace in Latin America and the Caribbean. And he will go ahead and correct his name. Number two is Mr. Edson Rosa. He is the Public Affairs and Religious Liberty Director for the Seventh-day Adventist Church in South America. Number three is Martin Burt, who is the Executive Director of the Paraguayan Foundation. Oh, we're going to change that. Yes, I'm sorry. The third presenter will be Miguel Enrique Núñez Durán of the Dominican Republic. Thank you for coming. He is the president of the Dominican Association for Religious Freedom. He'll be the third speaker. Number four then will be Mr. Martin Burt, the executive director of Fundación Paraguaya. And in the end, last we have Jader. He's already explained this to me. Is this Spanish or Portuguese? Okay, Jared Freire de Marcelo from Brazil. He's the Vice President of the Law and Religious Liberty Commission of Sao Paulo. So we will go ahead and continue with the presentations now. If you can come up here. Yeah, I'll need some help here. Okay, and then I change it with this one. And how do I change it like that? Okay, good morning. Good morning, everyone. And I join in the others in thanking the university. I think all of us are here for, all those of us who are here for the first time are greatly surprised by the wonderful warm welcome that we have received, and which also shows the particular nature of the members of the church that is at the head of this university in terms of having close relationships with their neighbor. And so I join all the others in thanking them for this. I'm going to have to go fast like everyone else has been doing this. And in particular, I'm going to touch on a very specific subject, as you can see in the title, which has to do with the advancement of participation of communities of faith communities in Track 1.5 and its backward movement in the Inter-American system. And those of us who work in those of you who work in diplomacy know much better than I what we're talking about. But track one is what in diplomacy is known as official discussions with participation of political high-level political and military leaders. Track two is non-official dialogues and activities that seek to resolve problems, and the interaction is much freer between high-level officials, and so it allows ideas to be fostered that also foster negotiation. And according to the opinion of various experts, there's an opinion that we also agree with and that we work a lot with, and that is track 1.5. And these are the situations in which official and non-official players work together, particularly in terms of religious groups and strategical alliances that facilitate collaboration between governments, NGOs, and faith-based organizations in order to promote peace and prosperity. And I'm going to briefly summarize this. I omitted mentioning what should be under 1.5 in the United Nations, the UN organizations, because I would like to eventually, and what we're concentrating on, our greatest concern, and so I'm going to mostly focus on regional examples. Regional and international organizations that is the most developed in terms of interfaith is the European Union, as we all know. Under the European president, it began in the 1990s, and with the Lisbon Treaty, which is the main treaty of the European Union, and which gave rise to a dialogue between, and so it is based on constitutional law, and the Lisbon Treaty says, and that there should be no discrimination against religious organizations, and with regard to the topic of this presentation, that they should recognize their individual contributions, so the EU will maintain an ongoing dialogue with churches. And since 2005, there have been this has been based on the three monotheist religions since 2005. And other people involved in this are the presidents of the European Commission and of the European Parliament and the European Council. Since 2010, these meetings have been much more extensive and have also included the participation of leaders from other religions, such as Hindus, whose history in Europe is much more recent. And on May 30th of this year, there was a meeting that had to do with spreading this European project. The Council of Europe, which is began in 2008 with annual exchanges on the religious dimension of intercultural dialogue. And last month in Armenia, there was a meeting, as you can see, that was dedicated to freedom of religion in today's world, challenges and guarantees. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe has its Office for Democratic Institutions and Human Rights. And it also there's also an advisory panel of experts on freedom of religion or belief, where the religious leaders are also present. In the African Union, they have signed a memorandum of understanding with the African Council of Religious Leaders. And from 2010, there has been an African Interfaith Dialogue Forum, and this has been on an official level with the African Union. And also elsewhere in the world, in the Asia and the Pacific, since 2004, Australia, Indonesia, a country with a Muslim majority, and also the Philippines and New Zealand, they have been promoting interfaith dialogues. The last one was last year and had to do with strengthening collaborative communities to promote regional peace and security. Interfaith in Action, which was held in Indonesia. And in our region, we are very advanced and we have a cooperation framework agreement. And for the third consecutive year, in fact, just last week, we held interreligious Latin American encounters as events prior to the Inter-American Summit. And these are civic meetings, and we have a specific meeting that has to do with culture in Latin America, and which has to do with our particular vision, which several weeks later, the heads of state of the Latin American community will be talking about this issue, and that will be on October 18th and 19th. And so this was held last week in Panama and has, in fact, to do with this very subject. In terms of integration in Latin America, this is something that is ever more relevant in the region. And this is something that is a little bit more complicated for the future in terms of a community participation within this framework within Track 1.5 that I've been referring to. The Caracas Action Plan, 2012 Caracas Action Plan, which is toward the end of 2011, and which had the attendance of President Hugo Chavez. And it has to do with fostering active participation of civil society, especially among organizations, social organizations, and movements. And this is something that we find very interesting as to how religious leaders could have participated in these forums. It would be difficult for me to imagine that these spaces, which such as the worldwide social forum, how high-level religious leaders such as cardinals and they would be participating on an equal level in terms of minorities, etc., etc. And last year in Santiago, there was the CELAC summit, and that was where the Caracas Action Plan was ratified. There was no modification to that. And for those of us who may be seeking an alternative way of participating, we recently signed a cooperation agreement with the Latin American Parliament, and this apparently is the Parliament of the of CELAC. And I'm asking for a few extra minutes, but this brings me to the central topic that we are dealing with here. Since 2007 until the present day, we have made all possible efforts to convince the Organization of American States to that because they don't respond to the specific needs of faith-based organizations. And so we're unable to imagine the presence of high-level hierarchies in our religious organizations. The typical space for civil participation is there are blocks of activities that are held during the days preceding each General Assembly, and it is very difficult for high-level religious leaders to participate in that, and that's why since 2007, in different dialogues we have suggested to the Organization of American States that there be a separate space in civil form so that there can be this inter-American participation. And this cooperation agreement and the memorandum of understanding include a permanent dialogue that annually will include an extraordinary session for the Organization of American States that will include religious leaders prior to each General Assembly. I say prior to because within the calendar of events, the calendar around the General Assembly is always so full. We have followed the course of negotiation that we have proposed, including in 2007. There was a meeting that the press never published, but this was seen in Italy and also by the Holy See, and there are meetings with the Pope, but for instance, the press has not been mentioning this. And following again what we've been asked to do, we're going to move forward little by little. It's just a difficult matter, and we've done this step by step. In 2011, we had a round table together with the Organization of American States, and then we decided that, well, let's put them to the test and see if we're going to manage to have a special space for us. And so after the round table, we made a formal proposal for religious organizations in America. And the proposal was rejected because it caused too many difficulties, because their agenda had to do with a homosexual agenda, and so they thought that it would be better not to have anything to do with us. And with this, I'll finish. We have concluded the only way to open an official path into the Organization of American States is to be at the next General Assembly in Paraguay. We have worked with some of the governments that are, let's say, closer to this idea, and so that together we can have a joint project that will favor a resolution in this area. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to be here participating in this 20th symposium in law and religion. Allow me to speak Portuguese. I could speak Spanish, and that would be just fine. And I have spoken in Spanish and worked with Latin American countries, but I will honor my language this morning, and will be a little bit of a break of the Spanish for you all, and you'll be able to enjoy the Portuguese for a minute. I'd like to thank the opportunity to be together, especially my friend from the church, LDS Church, Ney Garcia, this who is here, a great person, and his wife, also Dr. Gregory Clark and Elder Costa. Since last year, he invited us to be here, but we weren't able to be here. But Dr. Durham handed me a hand invitation, and I could not deny. So I had to come. I couldn't decline this time. It's a pleasure to be here. And we had the opportunity to work together with a lot of events with freedom of religions. And last year, we started organize celebrating 120 years of the National Association of Freedom of Religion in Portuguese. Yes. In 120 years, we have the activity, the opportunity to act in the freedom of religions field. And to prepare for this activity, we had opportunity to talk to these friends and organize symposiums and events for universities. We had the opportunity forums and symposiums, a music show, and a concert. It was Dr. Gregory went there with us. We had a great event, and we had all this celebration for this 120 freedom of religion, defending freedom of religion. So it was a great event. Around 25,000 people were there in a public square celebrating and honoring our leaders, religious and civil, who were there with us, present to celebrate with us. And we were able to recognize the defending of freedom of religions. And we try to work together as association to let the people be aware of freedom of religion. But at this point of the symposium, we have heard so many manifestations of rights, of human rights, freedom, religions of freedom, freedom of religion, sorry. And I would like to show another balance of this, another point, and I will leave the judicial point to Jader to present. I would like to analyze with you some of the Hebrew Christian vision of human rights. We can find this somehow in Genesis when we read in the first chapter, verse 26 and 27. Then God said, let us make mankind in our own image, in our likeness. And ahead it says, and man created, and the God created him, man in his own image, male and female, he created them. The foundation of human dignity within the Hebrew Christian vision is based in this text that I'm presenting. And also we can deduce that these are the reasons why we should respect people, as well as the base of individual freedom and also basic human rights. When the Bible says that God created man in his image and likeness, it speaks of relationship with God, created to communicate, and finally created to commune with him. Another aspect of human dignity based on this text is that as God is, human beings are invited to be. He is the model for all humanity. To understand the human being, it is necessary to understand some of the attributes of God. If God is the model, it means that whatever is said about God should be said about the human being. One of the attributes revealed in the Bible about God is that God is love. Whoever does not love does not know God, because God is love, in 1 John 4:8. For the Jews, the heart of their religion is God, and we read that in Deuteronomy chapter 6, 4 and 5, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. The Lord our God, the Lord is one. And the Lord told that to Israel through Jeremiah. And he said, I have loved you with an everlasting love. I have drawn you with unfailing kindness. It's a wonderful And it shows a wonderful declaration, shows the love of God towards Israel. In the New Testament, God is presented as someone who loves not only Israel, but the entire world. In John 3:16, "For God so loved the world that he gave his one only Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have eternal life." So it is not more love for Israel, but love for everyone. When God called Abraham, he said he would bless him and all families of the earth through him and through all his descendants. When God was speaking to Abraham, he had in mind all human beings, all of us. Mankind is not the result of a cosmic accident. Mankind has always been in the mind of God, even before it existed. One of the statements that we see that in this world is recorded in Matthew 25. It says, "Come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world." In other words, God thought of humankind before the foundation of the world. When we return to the statement of John that God is love, we can then see that God loves not only Israel, but he loves all mankind. His essence is love, and if he is love, humankind must also be love. God is holy. Humankind is called to be holy. God is sacred. Humankind is called to be sacred. Let's think about it in a personal aspect. Showing the individual who sits next to you right now is a holy person. This individual belongs to God. And we have asked three questions. When you sit by somebody in the airplane or in a place and somebody dresses differently than what you would usually choose, or they are dressed as their religion would advise them. So the first question, how do you feel when you are sitting by somebody who's dressed different than you? What do you think about that person? What do you do about that person? Those three questions are fundamental for our interreligious relationship. Sometimes we care more about an actual place, a specific place, like a chapel as a sacred place, more than a person. And it's not really like that. Paul said, "Don't you know that your body is a temple? It was given to you by God. You are not your own. Therefore, what matters to God should matter to humanity. Everyone must be respected. It is part of human dignity. God is love, and this attribute means relationship. God, as he created us, he wants to relationship with all his creatures, with humankind. But love and relationship cannot exist without freedom. For God, freedom is important because one cannot have love without freedom. You cannot tell someone, "You have to love me." That would be the end of love. Love is a decision that the individual makes. And no person may be forced. No one can force someone to love. And that is, for that reason, it's violating human dignity. God created and gave freedom so that love could be a reality. There can be no freedom without love, and love without freedom. And love is related to communion. Everything is connected with human dignity. God gave full freedom so that humankind could connect to him through love. When Jesus was in Palestine, on one occasion, many of his disciples turned back and no longer followed him. He turned then to the 12 and said, "You do not want to leave too, do you?" They had the right to choose. If they didn't have the right to choose, they would be like robots. In another occasion, he was going to Jerusalem, and he sent messengers ahead of him to prepare the place for him to stay. They enter a Samaritan village, but the people did not receive them. So James and John asked, Lord, do you want us to call fire down from heaven to destroy them? But Jesus said, you know not what manner of spirit are. For the Son of Man didn't come to destroy men's life, but to save them. And at the end of this text in Luke, it says that they went somewhere else. They found another place to stay. He did not come to destroy. He came to give life, to give the right of agency. And we are not only talking about religious freedom. We are talking actually about something deeper than that. We're talking about life. Life has to do with freedom. Life has to do with communication. Life has to do with relationships. If we ask a person what a corpse is, he may answer a lifeless body, a person with no life. Everything has to do with relationships. A corpse has no relationship, doesn't have a heartbeat, no more connections, no synapse in the brain cells. In other worlds, it doesn't have no words. It has no circulation, no communication. A corpse is a person who cannot communicate. Killing someone, it's putting them in a condition where they cannot communicate. Without freedom to have relationships, without freedom to move, or to think, or even to talk. For that reason, in one of the speeches from Christ, he said, you have heard that it was said to the people long ago, you shall not murder, and anyone who murders will be subjected to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. Anyone. And he said, who says you haka is answerable to the court? And someone said, you fool, will be danger of fire of hell. Nobody ever taught this way. He said that when you insult a person or are angry with someone, it's just like taking their life. All these attitudes have one thing in common. They confine people. When we isolate them, we take their freedom from them. We prevent them from communicating. And also, take from them the chance to have a relationship. So put them in a box. We violate their freedom. And in conclusion, Jesus said in Matthew, therefore, if you are offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, or you have something against a brother, go and reconcile. He came to promote life, to give life. And he said, I have come that they may have life, and they have it to the full. That is why within the Jewish Christian view, human dignity is extremely important. We have to have laws, we have to have conditions, we have to have regulations to protect people, all people, because people must have freedom to believe or not, freedom to make their own decisions, and never be forced to believe in something that would violate their conscience. People should never be put in a condition that they don't have a full freedom. There's no way to give freedom without dignity. Life is freedom and relationship. We should promote freedom because life is precious. And humankind is inviolable. Thank you.
First of all, I must insist on expressing my gratitude. I would like to thank BYU for this opportunity to be addressing all of you, and I must say that I feel tempted to rip up my passport to see if I can stay longer because of your wonderful hospitality, the hospitality of all those who have organized this event. And the only thing I can say is that I had been informed in the Dominican Republic that it would be I would have 20 minutes. Then later on, I was told that 15 minutes and now 10 minutes and perhaps less. So I'm not going to try to skip many of the things I wanted to talk about. Basically, I want to give a general outline to those who are not in the presentation provided by Judge Guevara in room 303. Because many of the aspects of church rights in the Dominican Republic were covered. So I'm going to cover what aspect religious freedom has in the Dominican Republic and where we can go from here. And to many of those who are not familiar with today's society in the Dominican Republic, I want to touch on some social aspects that I need to point out in the sense that according to a survey, a 2006 Gallup survey, the Dominican Republic, 69% of all Dominicans are Catholic, 40% practice in 29, 18% evangelical, and other Protestant, 10% don't profess any religion, and 3% are Seventh-day Adventist, Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Jehovah's Witnesses, Jews, and Muslims. And this is so that we can touch on where we should go in terms of protecting the rights of religious groups before the state. And in terms of the distribution of religions, like in most Latin American countries, the Catholic tradition is has been visible throughout the years. And in this case, 40% of all Catholics practice their religion and 29 are non-practicing Catholics. And if you look, we can go straight to what is basically the main outlook of the main sources, which are basically centered on the Constitution of the Dominican Republic and the international treaties on human rights, the concordat with the Vatican, and other legislative measures. And those who attended the presentation by Judge Guevara perhaps noticed that in the Dominican Republic there was a significant change in 2010 on the constitutional level. The Constitution had been amended about 30 or 38 times previously, but this time there is a fundamental change in terms of religious life. Was it in that area or in other areas that might favor religious freedom? And what happened was this. What happened was that the text that sets forth the freedom of worship and conscience remained virtually identical to what was in the previous constitutions. The other day, I was listening to López Pescador, Obrador. Yes, López Pescador from Mexico. No, I'm just kidding. Where they had the opportunity that we didn't have in 2010 of amending the text in terms of freedom of religion. In this case, the text remained the same, just like in previous constitutions. So we need to point out that in the beginning of our republic, toward the end of the 19th century and beginnings of the 20th century, the constitutions set forth that the Dominican Republic was a faith-based country because, and it declared this in favor of the Catholic Church. And there are some constitutions that maintain this text, but we can say that previously, in the 2010 Constitution and also farther ahead with the Concordat, this text remains virtually the same. And why was I concerned about this aspect? Because while as long as we're unable to define the scopes, then there are some loopholes that can be used in the future by and taken advantage of. In this case, as was mentioned previously, we're going to skip this due to lack of time, but we can say, and it says here in the second, but we can say that the amendment to the change in the Constitution meant something important, as I was saying. It was not important in a direct way in terms of the legal text of Article 46 with respect to the freedom of religious conscience and worship, but it was significant in terms of constitutional control. In this Constitution, we include constitutional guarantees for human rights and religious freedom. In fact, a constitutional court was created. We did not have a constitutional court that was separate from the Supreme Court of Justice. Presently, this institution has been in existence for about a year and 10 months and is presided over by my dear colleague, Dr. Guevara, who is here with us here. And though for those of you who are not in the previous session, he is the first president of the Constitutional Court. And among other provisions, it influences on what is can be the defense of other rights. Why? Because constitutional control is fundamental in the defense of fundamental rights. The Dominican Republic, in the Dominican Republic, we do had constitutional control through what was known as concentrated control, but this was held by the Supreme Court of Justice. And in this case, one could go straight to the Supreme Court to attack laws that might be in violation of the Constitution. And this concentrated control was different from the more widespread control that is in the current Constitution. And I'm going to pause right here with diffuse control. This was based and is based on the lower courts. And so any court in the Dominican Republic can recognize the constitutional issue, but not as had been said as something that results from a separation of the Constitutional Court from a Supreme Court. In 2010, this constitutional control became the Constitutional Court, which has the last word in matters of constitution. Because even though we presently do not have decisions that are related to the issue of religion, in this case, the issue of this very symposium, this balance that there needs to be in terms of interpretation of fundamental rights, we don't have decisions in that respect. So this is something that we will have to wait to see how it plays out. And as we will see later on, we will see some legal precedents, but from a prior period where constitutional control was carried out by the Supreme Court of Justice and not by the Constitutional Court, which is separate from the Supreme Court, which, as I mentioned, ceased to perform those functions. Among other provisions in the same framework, whew, I'm running out of air, but we're going quickly, and the international treaties also apply in the Dominican Republic. We have the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and also the American Declaration of the Dignity of Man. We have civil rights and also other provisions, because I had mentioned, why did I mention these treaties? Because the legal constitutional text sets forth exclusively what is known as the right to freedom of conscience and the freedom of worship. So one might ask, so what happens to the freedom of religion? Well, in this case, it is evident that in the text of the new constitution does include what constitutes the legal framework, which evidently includes, which obviously includes these international treaties. The advantage of this, in terms of the way it is written and the scope that it has, and all of you know this better than I do, is that the scope of the right to freedom of religion is widely defined and distinguished from the freedom of conscience and of worship. And as far as other sources of law, we have the Concordat, and I just wanted to briefly point out that this was signed in 1954, on June 19th of that year. It was an historic event back in the days of during the dictatorship of Rafael Trujillo, when fundamental human rights were obviously being violated. And in terms of international and internal pressure in what has to do with human with rights, and there are also other rules and regulations. Dr. Guevara also mentioned a law on marriages or the effect of non-Catholic marriages. In this case, it is obviously another important point. But what I'm looking for here is something that is a bit of a controversy, and that is whether the Concordat points out, and then there are many aspects in terms of the Concordat. The Concordat sets forth that the state recognizes the Catholic Church as the official church, and it also sets forth that the state recognizes that it is a perfect society and therefore grants unto it certain rights and privileges, as opposed to other religions. They're exempt from taxes, as certain ministers. The state contributes with public funds for the construction of church buildings and also in other aspects. However, I disagree with the fact that this can be considered in the Dominican state as a religious state, and for several other reasons. And the opinion of the president of the Constitutional Court is the same, in the sense that there are many aspects to this, and I'm skipping quickly to my conclusion, which is this legal precedent. And there's a legal precedent that evidently was from prior to the modification of the Constitution in 1910, but there are some aspects that defined this right to conscience and worship, which were preserved in Article 46 of the current Constitution. And I'm just going to interject something here. What is the context of this jurisprudence? This legal precedent has its origins in when a religious institution filed a claim on constitutional basis, and this decision rejects the impediment, saying that the Concordat is anti-constitutional. However, it established certain definitions that can be useful for the Dominican Republic. In this case, it talked about being a religious state, and like it says, there must be a confusion between this and other religions, so that it invade areas that it doesn't cover. And that's one of the reasons. There are many other reasons, but we're out of time, so I can't explain them. But this is one of the reasons why we can say that we're a religious state. But this does not mean that the Catholic Church should preserve certain rights. And the main thing is that there has to be the right of individuality. Not only religious freedom, but also other religious organizations. We must be based on equality. And during the plenary session, it was discussed that it's not just a matter of us reducing the privileges of somebody else, but of obtaining those privileges, and so that this right, just as it is set forth in the Constitution, can be achieved. And to conclude, in the sense that what this tells us is exactly that, well, I already told you that the decision is defined as freedom of conscience and freedom of worship, and it is important in term that freedom of conscience goes beyond the scope of religion. It also covers philosophical or other aspects, and this should call our attention to the need for a law, a Religious Freedom Act, which has been attempted previously, but which thus far has not been possible. There are efforts that are being made toward what I'm contributing to, as well as the efforts of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in the Dominican Republic, to establish a Religious Freedom Act. Now, why a Religious Freedom Act? Well, I'm moving onward because... But basically, I'm going to conclude trying to think that the need for a religious freedom law in the Dominican Republic is based on the fact that through such a law, many things can be accomplished without having to amend the Constitution. In this case, we can mention that the legal bill, or rather the blueprint that will subsequently be presented, which will be this year, includes other aspects that are aimed at eliminating the inequality between the religious organizations, and it would establish legal entity, which is what the Concordia gives the Catholic Church. But that way, currently the churches are organized as nonprofit organizations, but they would become legal entities. And this is something that Mexico was able to resolve as in a reform, and this is something we need to talk about: freedom of religion, freedom of conscience, and freedom of worship. And this provides for a better explanation and better ability to cover the scopes of these different areas, which is something that may be misinterpreted by the different courts, including our constitutional court. And so there are different aspects as to how we can be forced to carrying out marriages that perhaps are not in accordance with the religious belief of everyone. And in closing, I will just show the final conclusions, but I'd like to actually just leave all of this and move on to some motivation. I really liked that Mr. Anthony Hill from the University of Washington mentioned what is a particular concern of mine, not just in the Dominican Republic, but in all countries in Latin America that may be going through a similar situation. And what happens is that, in my opinion, we need to get together to defend and achieve a more deeply rooted declaration, a more valiant declaration in defense of religious freedom in all of its aspects. Because other groups have obtained rights due to their sexual preferences, and they do so with great force. And if we don't do that through the institutions so that we can achieve religious freedom, and in addition to the freedom of religion, this can be taken into consideration. If we don't do that, then we risk becoming a secular state. And so we need to make a greater effort in that area. And in this same context, I would like to congratulate this university and also the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, because with these symposiums and with all of its activities, they show the desire of making the defense of religious freedom a reality. Thank you very much.
He's not.
Muy buenos días.
Good morning. I want to add my gratitude for this hospitality, impressive hospitality that we are receiving. I work in the topic of poverty, and I think this opportunity to participate with such a prepared people to share with you a very modest point of view, which is, where is it related? Religion and the right to religion and the human rights and what it has to do with dignity. My country and the world, most of the population lives like this. And just a few miles away, another family lives like this. And we, with a group of civil organizations in Latin America and Africa, and also, I should say, with the support of universities like BYU from the United States, we are trying to find the role that has dignity in the exit of poverty, because materialism and the concentration on in the financial system doesn't resolve the problem. And so we are asking ourselves, why does this lady doesn't have any teeth? Is it because of her behavior, or is it because of the system where she lives, or is it because of her culture, or is it because of her own intention? And in this way, we rescue already from the left, from the central line to the left, the interiority of the human being. And from up and down, we rescue the personality, the individual personality and their function and collective life. And why doesn't she have money? Same question. Is it her behavior? Is it the system? Is it her culture? Or is it her intention? And why doesn't she have water? And so, precisely because of our organization with Utah, we are finding that to resolve the problem of poverty, we have to ask the poor, and you and I can be poor in something. If it's worth it to leave that situation, and if I have the capacity to do that, in English, it's worth it, and can I do it? Is it worth it means having the motivation, and am I capable of doing it? It has to do with the training and education. And so for each one of the poverty problems, we're appealing to this Utah group, Vital Smarts. They call the six sources of influence. And with this mechanism, we have brought out thousands and thousands of families from the poverty, not only in the income, but also in health and education. This is the theory, the positive influence, because we have found in Nigeria, Uganda, Mexico, Paraguay, Brazil, and Bolivia that in all the most poor countries, there are always people who are not poor, who have overcome poverty, and usually has to do with the rescue of their dignity. And so when we ask ourselves, what is poverty? We are concerned about the income, but we also look at the health, environment, education, and culture, living environment, infrastructure. But nobody wants to ask, because it's not politically correct or because they are subjective elements. It has to do with the interiority of motivation. And we have found with these six dimensions of poverty, we have defined what each one of these means with indicators. And for each indicator, we have found a critical situation in red, bad, yellow, kind of bad, and green, not poor. And so in these extremes, it would be like the extreme poverty, not extreme poverty, and not poor. And those are the indicators of poverty that in which we are working with. And the first ones you are familiar with. You have access to clean water. The family has at least two rooms, access to documentation. But here, we are trying to rescue. And is the family conscious of their needs? Do they have a life mapped? And do they have self-esteem? Do they have moral conscience? Do they have the capable emotional affective capability? And can they express themselves through art? Do they understand what beauty is? How is violence against women? Do they have a spirit of progress to come out of the poverty? And do they have autonomy and the capacity to make decisions? And we have found that appealing to these elements, the families come out faster from poverty than with a training course from the National Service of Vocational Education. And so we have to rescue the concept of dignity in the topic of human rights and the, how to come out of poverty, and to transcend the indicators, the traditional indicators. And we ask people, the poorest people, with photographs, which one of these pictures represent your situation? And she selects, and it's very important that she selects, because in the end, it will be her problem and not from the state. Because it's really important to know who's the poorest are. Is it from the poor or is it from the state? Madam, what kind of bathroom does the family have? If the family chooses the well from the tap with the tap water, if the family chooses one of these, which is the final result, the end result, and it becomes aspirational. We don't work with indexes, the index of the human development of the United Nations. The only thing they do is to add education plus health plus divided by three. And then they range the countries, or they give a range to the countries. And that's what they do. We work with technology. This will be a family stoplight, let's say, and all the families will have all the happy families are the same, and all the unhappy families are unhappy in their own way. We say that all the families from the middle class are the same, but the poor families are each poor in their own way, far from representing the complexity, and they are full of opportunities. And what we have done, and I won't have time to express this, we have gone to the urban communities, to the favelas, and for the poorest of the communities, and we have asked the poor people to define their level of poverty, and we have created a map. This is a map from a rural zone from Paraguay, and those are the families that don't have access to clean water. They have access, and the ones who don't have any problems with water. And we have a mechanism from how to come out of poverty. But I want to mention our insistence in the rescue of the role of the family and the head of the family to come out of the problem is not a state program or a government program, and that the poor belong to the state. Evidently, we don't believe that the poor families are an empty bottle or football that we need to put air into. But all the families have the potential that needs to be liberated, and that has to do with the human dignity. And in that way, we will go from that bathroom to this bathroom, and from that store to this small restaurant. And that girl that is condemned to be poor can become a young professional, and that young boy who is condemned to be poor can go to become a young professional, not appealing only to to the traditional recipes, but appealing to the human dignity. We have a short time, so thank you so much for your paying attention to this.
So long. We were supposed to.
We should stop at 12:15. Now it's 12:25, so I'm going to change everything. It's already changed.
That's already done.
I will speak in Portuguese, and I will give the translator a real hard time, but I will change everything first because we have to respect the time, and we are already 10 minutes late. We had 10 minutes. I had 2 minutes to speak. I'll try to speak in 3 minutes. And to speak for 3 minutes, I will make only 2 reflections here. I come from a country where the matters of freedom of religion is relatively easy. We have a constitution with a clause that I will read to you. It says that we cannot violate the liberty of freedom and have the free exercise of religious cults guaranteed, assured by the law and its practices. In its practice, we are a laic state since 1891. In other words, we have over 100 years of 130 years of laic state, a state separated from religion, and that caused our legislature to perfect to the point of having mechanisms that punish attack protection towards freedom of religion. But that does not mean that we do not have problems. A laic state, it's compound by individuals, and individuals have their own religions. Maybe one of the main attributes of the human being. I've never found in all my studies, all my research, any society that did not have a religion. So to assure the right to believe or not to believe what is implied in our Constitution does not mean that individuals do not have their own religious convictions, and in this context, some expressions of intolerance arise, and these expressions of intolerance generate the problems that cause us to be here talking about this. Although the first time that we talked about religion, freedom of religions, as far as I know, was in 1215 in England, when it was restored to the Protestants to bear their own arms. Their right was suppressed by James II, the king. So 900 years have come by, and we are still discussing freedom of religion as if it was a total new concept that we know nothing of. We are still discussing for 900 years something without knowing what that means. I'm not saying that we in Brazil know what it is. In spite of having an extensive legislature, and our constitution is 25 years old, will be this week. And in these 25 years, we have a clause, an article, that obligates people to admit the freedom of religion. And recently, 9 years ago, the Brazilian Bar Association created a commission called the Commission for the it's equivalent to the American Bar Association, and it has a public function. It's not, we are part of
somos un organismo.
It has a social obligation, a social duty. It's easier to explain this way. And this commission works to mediate the conflicts. And I would like to bring two examples. 2 years ago, a group of from an evangelical group was beaten inside a train in the city of São Paulo, was beaten because some of the passengers there were not happy that they were reading the Bible aloud. I'm speaking in Portuguese. I don't know what the joke is. I'm not talking in Spanish. I'm speaking in Portuguese. So we were called, and we spent a few days teaching classes of a policy, a law enforcement approach. And a few days, we also talked to those religious leaders so that we could make them understand that although they had the right to proselytism, it is commonplace. On the other hand, people may not want to listen to it. In Brazil, we found a way to mediate these questions, not to judge men at the courts. Mahatma Gandhi said once that religions are ways, different ways converging to the same point. It doesn't matter if we follow different ways so long as we reach the same objective. And I think that with that sentence, he can say exactly what we are looking for 900 years. I think that's the only reflection I'd like to leave with you. Why 900 years and we are still debating what is freedom of religion, what is human rights? I put together a paper based on the topic that Eliseu has just expounded. I think everything I wrote, he was able to put in a single sentence. The human right is what awakens the human dignity. I put on my thinking about human thinking, human dignity. I like to give another example to all, but I would like to conclude. I think I've been able to pass on the idea that the only way existent to reconcile conflicts is moderating them, not taking them to courts, although I'm an attorney, in spite of the fact that I'm an attorney, and 3 minutes have passed, I know. Liberty as a concept is a right, as a function, it is a conquest, according to the thinker Spinoza, but is a conquest permanent to the point that when everybody can understand that the rule of law can only exist through the respect to laws, disrespecting laws, the law, even if the law does not teach common sense, it's to create coercions. Every time I create a coercion, history has shown us in the past 900 years that does not work. Einstein said once, it's easier to disintegrate an atom than disintegrate a discrimination, a prejudice. Thank you very much.
Desintegrar un átomo que desintegrar este método. Muchas gracias.
Bueno, muchas gracias a los ponentes. Favor de darles otra agradecimiento.
And a question for those who are directing the symposium. Are there papers available? Not mine. Well, what we can do... If you turn in your written presentations, they're all going to be made available online on our symposium's website. Well, thank you very much. This was very interesting, and the ideas that you presented were very interesting, and I'm sure that they'll be available. And if you want to follow them and ask them questions on our way to lunch, but we're going to go to the same place where we had lunch yesterday, and I'm certain that they will also be available and will be sitting with you in case you have any questions. Well, thank you very much, everyone.